Well, now, this morning, I was dealing mainly with two key ideas, one of which was the physical universe as a system of intermeshing spectra, depending on each other and playing with each other in the same way as warp and woof in weaving. And I underline the notion that these spectra are different dimensions rather than components of the physical world. And that although I'm using the word physical here, I'm using it in the sense of its original meaning, natural, rather than the later meaning that has been attached to it, that is to say, material world. The world envisaged by analogy with ceramics, the material world considered as a world made out of stuff. You see, as we all know, stuff is supposed to be something inert and stupid, which can't do anything. And therefore, in order that stuff may be found in intelligent shapes, it has to be informed by an external energy, an external intelligence, so as to be brought into shape. And this is the idea of the world based upon the analogy between creation and carpentry, or creation and ceramics, or creation and sculpture. Just in parentheses, good ceramists and sculptors don't treat their medium as if it was stupid. They know that the potter, who is a good potter, knows that there is life in clay, and that he has to respond to that life in order to do the work of pottery properly. But those who are not themselves artists don't know this, and therefore the public has been bamboozled for centuries on the notion that patterns have to be composed of some sort of basic stuff. Now I was trying to substitute for that sort of conception of the world the idea of interweaving a spectra which are different dimensions of energy or of patterning. And I used advisedly the verb patterning as distinct from the noun pattern, because when you use nouns in combination with verbs, you obscure language. Watch out for this. This underlies many people's misunderstanding of things, is the differentiation of noun and verb. It's an entirely unnecessary differentiation. And it gives one the impression that wherever there is an action going on, that is to say, something appropriately described by a verb, there must be some other kind of thing than an action, which is described by a noun, and to this is ascribed the origin of the action. So when you say, there is thinking, because the verb has to have a subject, which is a noun, someone says, well, who is thinking? Obviously, there can't be any thinking without a thinker, without a who that thinks. And that is a question, a problem that arises, simply because it is a convention of our grammar that every verb has to have a subject, which must always be a noun. So a noun stands for a thing, and a verb stands for an event. And we therefore suppose that events are caused by things. But if you ask a person what he means by a thing, he will never be able to tell you. He will give you a series of synonyms, such as object, fact, whatever. But all these are simply alternate words for thing. Then what do you mean by an event? You say process, etc. And it's equally vague. You can always describe events in terms of things, and equally, you can describe things in terms of events. If I want to say, ordinary, while the cat sat on the mat, the dog went for a walk around the house. That's noun-verb language. But I can equally say, while the catting sat on the matting, the dogging went walking around the dwelling. And I've changed the whole sentence into verbs, and it's still as clear as it was in the beginning. Or I can turn it all into nouns. The cat, seat upon the mat, the dog upon a walk around the house. It's all nouns. But in one, in a noun world, of course, you'll have a static world. In a verb world, you'll have a dynamic world. But there aren't, for example, if you take the word fist, is a fist a noun? Yes. But it describes a process. Not properly a noun, because this noun suddenly vanishes. This thing, fist called fist, disappears the minute I open my hand. What happened to it? See, I stopped fisting, and I went into handing. So in the verb language has a little edge over the noun language as being better suited to the kind of process that nature is. So when you realize that you can discuss the whole of nature in the verb language, you don't have to ask the question, who started it? You don't, in other words, have to seek for a noun as the explanation of the verbs. You don't have to seek for something that is not process to start process off. So, this then is the language I'm using when I talk about patterning as the basic goings-on of the physical world, and patterning can be described and measured and so on and so forth. So then, the other point that I was making particularly was in the spectrum, you have the extremes of the spectrum. The sound and the silence, the light and the dark, space and solid. And I was showing how by the yin-yang philosophy of the Chinese, how these extremes are not opposites but poles. They go together. They require each other. You know one in terms of the other. And so in this way, you don't have the world as an opposition of light and darkness, of being and non-being, in such a way that one of the poles could exist alone, either being or non-being, non-being or being. Because the whole nature of poles is that without both of them there are neither. And so if we have a polar universe, then you don't, have to worry, as if this was something to worry about, that the play, the music of existence might cease forever and ever and ever. In that kind of cosmology argument that's now going on, you know, there are two dominant theories of cosmology among physicists. One is the steady state theory, and the other is the explosion theory. The steady state people want to make out that hydrogen, free hydrogen in space, is all the time, as it were, coagulating and forming itself into new bodies, whereas the explosion theory people, who have the edge of the argument at the moment, say there was originally an enormous concentration of energy which blew up and expelled all the galaxies from it, which went floating out, and the whole thing is gradually dissipating itself radioactively until it will reach a state of quiescence. And of course, if you have a Judeo-Christian mind, which thinks of time in a linear way instead of a circular way, you'll think that's awful, because the whole thing is running down, and when it's finished, that'll be it. But you see, I always want to ask the question, well, what was it like before the Big Bang went off in the beginning? Probably pretty much the same state of affairs as when it all petered out in the end. In other words, whatever happened once can always happen again, given enough time or given enough something or other. I'll settle for either the steady state theory or the Big Bang theory. It doesn't make much difference, except by way of describing the pattern, how it happens. The question of whether it happens, I always figure that whatever did happen could happen again. You know, I like to think about myself. Well, I'm a kind of a funny phenomenon that this universe is doing. And it's done me this time. It may do me again later on, maybe a million years from now. It'll do me again, not quite the same way, but rather like me, near enough to be me. You know, like you play the piano, and you play a certain piece, and then you stop, and the piece is dead. Then you think, well, let's play it again. And you play the same piece again. It's the same piece, but it's a different playing. Play the tape recorder. I've got the tape on here. I can play it. Then it stops. Then, several days later, we can put it on and play it again. It's a little different, probably, but same process. And every time the universe plays any one of you, each one of you it plays is I. See, everybody calls himself I. And you feel like you're I just as much as I feel I'm I. That is to say that you're the middle, the sensitive center, out of which everything looks. And you call yourself I, well, that's my name. And everyone is I. The only trouble about being I is that you can only be one at a time. See, when a child asks, who would I have been if my father had been someone else? Mommy. He says, well, the funny questions children ask. Well, you had to be someone in order to be anyone. But every someone is I. And it's all, as it were, the same I, looking out through different eyes. You put an electric light inside a black sphere and make holes in the sphere, and all the holes are different, but the light at the bottom of it's the same. Something like that. That's a kind of a rough analogy. But anyone knows from a physical point of view that every organism is simply a pattern of behavior which can't be separated from the pattern of behavior which we call its environment. It's all one pattern. Except the one pattern, like every one pattern, give me a pattern. And every pattern, look at these bamboos. Here's a pattern. And every pattern has wiggles in it, and sub-wiggles, and sub-sub-wiggles. See, the main wiggle is the stem. Then the twig come out as a sub-sub-wiggle. The leaf comes out as a sub-sub-wiggle. And if you look into the leaf, there are sub-sub-sub-wiggles. And that's the way it goes. They all belong to the pattern. It's difficult, too, to say who's wiggling what. Is the stem wiggling the leaves, or are the leaves wiggling the stem? Both arguments are equally valid. The universe is doing me, and I'm doing the universe, because the universe depends on my optic nerves and all that structure to turn the sun into light. Wouldn't be light if there weren't any eyes. Just like a hand on a drum. If there's no skin on the drum, there'll be no noise. It takes two to make love, and to make an argument, to do anything. That's the yang and the yin. Well, now, let's go through this spectrum, or begin to go through it. I'm not going to go all the way through it this afternoon. You begin at the end of sleep, torpor, and we'll go as far as number three. Do you know that sleep is a very mysterious subject? Scientific students of sleep are not yet at all sure what sleep is. Apparently people need it, but nobody really knows why they need it from a strictly scientific point of view. And we apparently need to dream in sleep also. People who are deprived of dreams get very, very restless and unhappy. But we're not quite sure why we need dreaming. I mean, we've got all sorts of theories, the Freudians and the Jungians and so on. They think they know why we need to dream. But it hasn't been really rigorously established scientifically why we do or why we need to sleep. But from a naive point of view, you can say, of course I need to sleep. Because after I've had a whole day of busyness and friends and work and so on, it's too much. There's too much input. I want to digest it. And while I'm digesting it, I don't want any more input. I don't want any more information. So I want to be turned off. That's, you know, one of those simple common sense things that everybody knows but has not yet been fully explained. So sleep is this marvelous thing that we have, which is a forgettery process that is apparently essential to our psychic health every 12 hours or so. And if you don't get it, you start getting worried. As a matter of fact, insomnia is a thing that is rather curious. Because if you do get insomnia, the worst thing of all to do is to worry about it. Invariably, if I can't sleep, I don't try to go to sleep, I get up and work. Or do something. Or I read a very difficult book, especially one that is big and weighs a lot. This is a good way to go to sleep. But if you have insomnia, don't try to ever try to go to sleep. Nobody can try to go to sleep. Lots of mothers think they can get their children and they say, darling, try to go to sleep. Didn't your mother say to you, try to go to sleep? Or she wanted to get you out of the way. That was the only reason she said, try to go to sleep. Or she thought perhaps it was good for you and that you ought really to get your sleep. It's like telling some child that it's got to eat its spinach. And, you know, the child can start chewing and chewing and chewing on meat or spinach, which tastes of nothing, and it chews it into an absolute hard, stiff pulp, and there's just nothing to be done with it except spit it out. And, you know, they've already extracted by their teeth instead of their stomach all the vital juices from the thing, and all that remains is roughage. And you say to children, you must go to the bathroom after breakfast. Every day, regularly. You must be regular. Otherwise you're constipated and that's bad. This is a form of the double bind. You know, you are required to do that which will be good only if it's done voluntarily. So try to go to sleep. It is impossible. Sleep has to happen because it's a spontaneous activity and it can be helped, as we shall see when we come to consider torpor. But by and large, sleep is a spontaneous activity and is a way of turning yourself off to get away from the bombardment of awareness and forget, because forgetting renews. And that also is a function of all demolitions, of deaths, of destruction of patterns, of knocking down buildings, of the whole change process in the universe. Because we want to do what we've done before over again, only if you remember it too often, it'll become boring. So if you forget, Then you can do it again, and it'll be just as amazing as it was the first time. And so there absolutely has to be a forgettery built into this universe in just the same way and for just the same reasons that there must be an eliminative process in the body as well as an eating process. And both are vitally important. And you see, we have very different attitudes to the two. Eating is something we do socially, eliminating is something we do privately. Eating we consider, we want the all good smells and all that kind of thing. Eliminating is all bad smells and that kind of thing. But this is largely social conditioning that tells us this. But nevertheless, these are the two sides of the game we play, and there's a spectrum between the two. So in the same way here, you have to forget, just as you have to eliminate, so that everything is renewed because it can happen again without being boring. Things that happen all the time, in any way, begin to pass out of consciousness. For example, if there is a constant noise going on while we're talking, it will annoy us at first, but after a while we shall cease to notice it. If it's constant. But if it keeps varying and coming on in different volumes and different rhythms, it'll hold our attention all the time. So anything that just goes diggity-ding, 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 you eventually cease to notice. So then, sleep is the renewer because it's the state of forgetfulness. I'm not going to go in this seminar into the whole problem of dreams. That would lead us very far afield. Now, torpor describes something approaching sleep. But this also is a valuable state because it's very comfortable. One can, in sleep, you're not aware of sleeping. But in torpor, you are aware of the comfort of tiredness and minified consciousness. It is a sort of pseudo-return to the womb. And so when after a hard day's work where people have been irritating and combative, you go home or you go to the local bar and you down a number of martinis, they turn you off and they put you into a state of near torpor, or what is quite correctly and scientifically called by this learned and funny word, narcosis. Narcosis, Narcissus, you know, is connected with narcosis. It means torpor, reduced consciousness, reduced sensory input. And the reason why Narcissus is associated with narcosis is that Narcissus, when he saw his reflection in the water, didn't know it was himself. And he became so fascinated by this image in the water that he became unaware of everything else. He got hung up, or shall we say, to use current slang, hooked on his own image. And he didn't know it was his own image. That was the only reason he could get hooked on it. So Narcissus and narcosis are associated. And so the permissive narcotic in our culture is alcohol. And other narcotics like opiates exist. But you must remember that you can only correctly use the word narcotic of something inducing the state of consciousness which is torpor. Now you can do it by massage, by relaxation exercises, by hot tubs, many, many ways of inducing torpor. You're not in torpor, you're not truly relaxed, because you tend to lose muscular tonus, which you always retain in true relaxation. But you begin to go like a limp rag. Now there's a place for that in life. And it's good as a way of sleep induction for people who have insomnia and are so anxious that they don't allow themselves to be turned off. I would want to say in general a good word for sleep and torpor, because a lot of people are against them. Ushpensky, who was Gurdjieff's sort of St. Paul, and as much as a misinterpreter in a way too, always felt that his life was a war against sleep, that intense light consciousness should conquer darkness. Now that's a stupid idea. To be a human being, you have to love the light, but you also must trust yourself to the darkness. Be able to be, let yourself go in the faith that you'll arrive back all in one piece. I have a friend who calls her name is Charlotte Selver, and she does a kind of work for which there is no name. She calls it sensory awareness. And one of her experiments is to get a person to lie on the ground, and simply she says to them, now, it's all right, the ground is going to hold you up. So just lie down, and there's nothing else you need to do, because the ground is firm and it will hold you there. Then she examines the person's body after a while and says, look, do you know what you're doing? You're trying to hold yourself together, as if your skin weren't strong enough to contain you. And you're doing this all the time to keep yourself from falling apart. Why? You think, do you, that if you don't hold yourself together, you're just going to go blah and disappear into some kind of frightful green jello? No, you won't. In the same way, a lot of people, it's why we wear such ridiculous clothes, especially women. Men are pretty bad, but women, the men do it around the neck. You know, that necktie, a symbol of slavery. It's a noose to strangle you with. But you feel tight, really held in here, and held in by the belt, and women wear girdles that hold them in like this, and the coat that fits your body, jacket, you know, you put it on, and it fits, and you're squeezed, or you get these tight pants that hug you, and you know you're there. Other people, of course, don't know they're there till they're sitting on spikes. Then they really know they're there. And a lot of people make trouble for themselves in order to be able to sit on spikes so that they know they're there. Now, supposing instead you switch to another kind of clothes, you wear Japanese clothes. I often wear Japanese clothes because they happen to be, for men, the most comfortable form of clothing ever devised. There's only one place where it holds you, and that's at the belt. But you wear the belt not round your waist, but below your belly. And you wear it rather loose. Otherwise, the garments are flowing. They don't interfere with the nature of the cloth, because the cloth is woven on a rectilinear pattern. See? Cloth is straight like this. So when you get a Japanese kimono, it folds up instantly for packing. But you try to pack a Western man's jacket or a woman's suit jacket, and there's absolutely no way of folding the thing at all. So it always comes out of your suitcase needing to go to the pressing. But you take a kimono and you put it on, and it falls exactly according to its own nature around you, and they're very dignified. And you feel, but you don't feel closed in. Now that makes some people terribly uncomfortable. If they don't feel pinched and pulled together, they don't feel dressed. And feel this as I'm going around in the bathrobe. And a lot of people can't wear a bathrobe beyond a certain hour of the day because they don't feel that they're respectable. I mean, you can perfectly well get up and put yourself into the most beautiful, any kind of gorgeous bathrobe you want to, and run around and do your work if you don't have to go to the office. Even if you had to go to the office, they ought to allow you to wear interesting robes. And furthermore, I once asked a Japanese why he didn't wear a kimono anymore. And he said, you can't run for a bus in a kimono. Well, it's perfectly true. Unless you hoist it up and tie it into the belt, you can't. And that's rather undignified. But the thing is that in this age that is now forthcoming, when we're going to cut down the working hours because of automation, people have got to learn to saunter and dawdle. Otherwise, they'll get into mischief. And so forms of clothing which are supremely comfortable, which require a kind of a sauntering attitude to life, are going to be very important for the future of civilization. This pitch for the kimono. Now, but this is all to do with letting yourself go into the earth, into the darkness, as it were, and trusting the world that lies below you as much as you might trust the world that lies above you. Drop. Fall freely in space. That's a marvelous sensation. It's like floating. That's why people do skydiving. Because just until they pull that parachute, they have the sensation of flying. Even though they're dropping very fast, they get the sensation. Total freedom. Whee! See? That's what everybody's looking for. So we get that in a way in sleep. The arms of Morpheus. And the idea of sleep as healing. Some psychiatrists are very keen on the idea of putting their patients by hypnosis and other methods into long, long periods of sleep, where they feel completely secure and looked after, nothing to worry about. I have a favorite sleeping place. It's a house on top of the hills in Hollywood. There's a great eucalyptus tree, and underneath this there is a deck. And I like to get a sleeping bag and lie on my back underneath this eucalyptus tree and look up at the stars through the shadows of the leaves and just go. See, it is a marvelous feeling. Well, now, we come now to this, the things of sleep, where I will say this one thing about dreaming and about torpor. We know the motto, in vino veritas, in wine the truth comes out. Of course, it also has a subtle double-take meaning. All popular sayings have many levels of meaning. And it's a Christian saying, in vino veritas, belongs to the Western culture. It also means, in the wine is the true blood of Christ, the Catholic Mass. And that refers to the fact that life requires death, the drinking of blood. But in the sense of in vino veritas, a person reveals himself, lets go of himself, lets his unconscious come out when he is drunk, or also in sleep when the dreams come up and show the inner side of things. You will see in that way that these two states can in a certain sense be creative. They let things come up which are normally put down. Because number three spectrum, the waking state of what we will call symbolic consciousness, is highly guarded. It is the most guarded of all these states. Now then, I want you to understand then that the ordinary state of consciousness, what you call normal consciousness, is by no means a frank, objective awareness of the real world. Not by any means at all. It is a state of highly cultivated, hothouse-reared, special ways of perceiving the world, in accordance with symbolic formulae. And it all depends on your orientation to the physical world as to what you see in it. You know the story of the tailor who went to see the Pope? And they asked him, what was he like? And he said he was a 41. Or a woman who says to a man, you saw Mrs. So-and-so today?
Yeah.
What was she wearing? She had no idea. You didn't notice, but you saw. But you didn't pay attention, because you weren't interested in what she had on, but what she had off. Or whatever it be. So, we notice according to what we are programmed or conditioned to notice by our social conditioning, that is to say, our upbringing, our education, our professional needs, our survival needs, so do we notice what's happening. Now, supposing somebody from an entirely different planet came into this room and started looking at us, and he wasn't programmed to notice the things that we notice, he would ask the most amazing questions about what we're doing. He had noticed that most of us have standard ways of holding our hands. Why do some of you sit like this? Why do some of you sit like this? Why do some of you sit like this? Why don't you do this? Wouldn't that be an obvious thing to do with your hands? Just let them hang. Very few people ever do that, because they feel a funny feeling they get that they got a couple of wet fish down here. They don't know what to do with. See? And then he noticed all sorts of funny things about us that we would never occur to us to think about. And he would notice, for example, you might say, well, what color is a human face? You know, the comic strip artists tell you, pink or brown. They do a black outline and then they color the whole face pink. Now, for a change, take a real good look at a face. And you'll start seeing that it just doesn't have a particular color. Not only does it depend where the face is in relation to the available light and what it's reflecting, but also it's a patchwork of all kinds of subtle color changes and is full of funny hairs and spots and all sorts of things, which we're not supposed to see, especially on ladies. You know, girls, men don't care so much if they have a hair somewhere, but girls carefully pluck hairs out with tweezers and make them disappear so as to get as smooth a texture as possible. The Japanese go so far as for a beauty to cover herself completely with a white paste so that she's got complete pancake makeup, dead white. And when a Japanese photographer takes a picture of you, you'll never recognize yourself, because he works out every wrinkle, every shadow, and presents you as a complete mask. Because it's inauspicious to have shadows. When a Westerner first painted one of the emperors with the shadows showing, they said, but you can't paint the emperor that way. His face is not dirty. And besides, it's inauspicious to have a shadow fall on the imperial visage. So, you can see shadows. The artist Rembrandt taught you to see shadows. Leonardo taught you to see shadows. But modern painters have discovered that shadows aren't darkness. Shadows are light. Shadows are color. Shadows are full of vitality. So you begin to get vivid purple shadows. People say, well, but you don't go around with a purple shadow on you, do you? What do you mean? Do you? You think that a shadow is brown because you haven't ever looked at a shadow. And you don't realize that shadows are absolutely vibrant with light. We'll go more into that later. when we come to this number seven. But there it is, you see, the world that we see or think we see is actually not the world at all, but is a selection of things that are in the world, a selection governed by certain symbolic processes. What a man ought to look like, what a woman ought to look like. And we try ourselves to dress and to behave in such a way as we live up to the symbolic requirements that are expected of us. So then, we think there's a certain kind of work that is worthy of being done. And you ought to be tinker, tailor, soldier, sailor, doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief, or whatever it is. And you ought to fit into one of these roles. Of course, there are innumerable things one might do. Infinite. But we like to get classified. We want to know whether you're a Republican or whether you're a Democrat. Whether you belong to the left wing or to the right wing. Whether you are a Christian, a Jew, Baptist, Methodist, whether you're a Mohammedan or what you are, just so long as we can get you put into a compartment. That is to say, into a symbolic classification. Now, what is the reason for that? Well, this kind of consciousness here is based on a very peculiar specialization of the human brain, which we call, in everyday life, conscious attention. That is the capacity to focus or concentrate awareness upon what we call any one thing at a time. It's as if, in other words, conscious attention were a spotlight, and that the rest of awareness were a floodlight. In other words, every nerve end in your body is receiving input all the time, is in that sense energized, is aware of everything that comes to its into its periphery. So you are taking in the totality of your surroundings. But conscious attention is flipping from point to point to point to point to point like this, and is making sense out of what it sees by adding it up with memory. It's an immense advantage from some points of view to be able to have this faculty, because it does the same sort of thing for the human organism that radar does for a ship. That is to say, the function of radar is to scan the surroundings of the ship and watch out for unexpected changes in the environment. And radar is a scanning process. In other words, it is a beam that goes out and bounces against things and feeds back the bounce to the screen. So in exactly the same way, consciousness or conscious attention is always scanning the environment and watching out for new eventualities that might be threatening or that might present favorable opportunities for some sort of advancement. Now, conscious attention has to be programmed as to what to attend to, what is important to look out for, so that we say to baby, now when we're teaching it language, watch out for the cars on the street. Watch out for that dog. Watch out for this. Watch out for that. This is programming the baby's radar. But we, as a human community, have put so much importance and so much psychic investment into our radar that we believe ourselves to be that. We identify the self with the radar and not with the rest. so that we get this sort of a situation. When I say, I do this, I walk, I talk, I think, I run, I hit. But other things, such as the beating of the heart, the breathing of the lungs, the functioning of the glands, the constellation of the shapes of the bones, are all defined not as anything I do, but as something that happens to me. Just in the same way, when it rains, it happens to me. I don't rain. But I do walk. And so, in other words, what has happened here is that we have identified ourselves with the point of origination of conscious attention and with the point of voluntary control. That's me. Anything else happens to me. So in this way, we have disowned most of ourselves. It's not me. The body you have is merely a vehicle that you go around in like an automobile. So if I would say to some young woman, gee, you're beautiful. She might well reply, if she were highly influenced by our culture, oh, you're so like a man. All you think about is bodies. I may be beautiful, but I got my body from my parents. And I want to be admired for myself and not for my chassis. See, she's a poor little chauffeur. That's how she defines herself. She disowned herself. She disowned her body and said, it was given to me by my parents. I'm not responsible for it. Or a child in rage can say to its parents, I never asked to be born. It was you who brought me into this world. And that child doesn't know that when the father was going after the mama and there was just an evil gleam in his eye, that evil gleam in your father's eye was you. Just as it was you, that was the little spermatozoan that made it. It was you that was that fetus. If your heart is you, all that was you too. But you see, this waking consciousness, symbolic consciousness, ignores that altogether, because it sets limits, and rather arbitrary limits, to what you are. You are just that voluntary center. You are that beam of consciousness that sweeps over the environment and sees things in series one after another, especially if you use a language which uses an alphabet. Alphabets spell everything out one after another. And you see, in other words, these sort of words strung together into sentences which build up meanings. Whereas on the other hand, if you work in terms of an ideographic language, although it's true that an ideograph has parts like words do, the parts of a word always follow each other in this direction. Whereas the parts of an ideograph may go in an entirely different direction. See? This, which is the Tao in Chinese. I take it in all at once. I need a sentence to translate that word in English. But it's more of a picture than it is like ordinary words. And as you grasp all the elements of the picture simultaneously, you see the form altogether at once. That is nearer to the way nature exists. Nature, things in nature exist altogether at once. Everything's happening altogether everywhere all at once. You know, And we say, well, in words, it won't stop for you to describe it. Take too long. By the time you've described it, it's all different. So, we do, you see, luckily for us, have an aspect of our organism which is paying attention to all the things we don't notice. This is how you can walk without stumbling, how you can drive a car downtown and at the same time carry on a conversation with a friend, because it is your subconscious, as it were, or whatever you call it, that is taking care of the driving and is watching out for the red and green lights and for the other cars, while your consciousness is preoccupied with a conversation. So, however, in a culture where the value of spotlight consciousness is exalted, and that is you, then do you see you have an exceedingly great need for state number two, for torpor. Because the spotlight is so bright, and you can have too much of it so fast. And also, if you identify yourself with that only, you identify yourself with the troubleshooting aspect of your organism, and you become relatively unaware of the amazingly harmonious and happy states of your organism that are going on all the time. And in times you see certain kinds of culture, certain epochs in history, people emphasize that you've always got to be on the watch. And they regard it as very sinful to relax into the beautiful, wonderful processes that are going on in us that are harmonious constantly. See, to enjoy breathing. That's a silly thing to do, most people would say. Well, enjoy breathing? What's that going to achieve? And this is all goes back, you see, to this Christian idea. Brethren, be sober, be vigilant. For your adversary, the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about seeking whom he may devour, whom resists steadfast in the faith. You know the hymn, Christian, dost thou see them on this holy ground? How the powers of darkness prowl and prowl around. Christian, up and fight them, you know. And wowee, it's going on all the time. See, you're never safe. Just as there are termites in the basement, gnawing away. Parasites in your blood. Probably a few little cancer cells kicking up somewhere. Go to the doctor, inspect, check up. Once every 2 months, watch, it's coming, see? It's coming. And you've got to correct it here, correct it there, keep everything going. Otherwise the weeds keep coming in. If you don't watch out, the birds are all over the roof. Birds, you know, keep watching human beings. And the minute the birds got any idea that a house is really vacant, they're going to move in. Squirrels, rats, everybody is waiting. And so on the spiritual level, there are the demons. They're just waiting, watching for you. So stay awake. Don't dare go to sleep. Don't ever relax. Because if you do, in it will come. Watch therefore and pray. You never know when it's going to happen. So this is the complete identification of man with his troubleshooter, which has got to be on the watch. Now the only difficulty about this is that when you manage to protect yourself so successfully against all the powers of darkness, you reach a point where you become the kind of creature that's no longer worth protecting. It's the same sort of thing that happens that if to defeat the Nazis you have to become Nazis, what was the point of the fight? if to defeat the Gestapo and the secret service of the Red Chinese and all that plot, we have to have a secret police ourselves who are going to be just as bad as theirs, what is gained? What are you protecting? See? The biggest farce of all is this, that if you want to know the real lowdown on the next war, join the Air Force and be safe. Because the only people who are really going to be protected are the guards. You know, you'll be able to have either be way up there, or else you'll be in great, vast basements in Nevada, where they've built under-mountain airports with all sorts of oxygen tanks and supplies and things to last forever. Because what a farce the whole thing has become. The original idea of guards and soldiers was to protect the women and the children. Now what we do is we have the women and children bombed out of existence in the cities, whereas the guards are guarded. So all guarding eventually becomes guarding of guards. It's circles of defense protecting circles of defense. And in this way, mammals turn into mollusks. A mammal is so constructed, you see, that the hard stuff is on the inside and the soft stuff on the outside. A mollusk is the other way around, with the hard stuff on the outside and the soft stuff on the inside. Well, nature favors a bit mammals over mollusks, because a mammal is more sensitive, more responsive. See, a mollusk, you go donk on it and it doesn't feel anything. Whereas the mammal is really pliable, which is why, of course, in military tactics we abandoned armor. A knight in armor was completely helpless once he was unhorsed. Because he wore this armor, but he depended upon the forward rush of the horse and his lance to just blow through everything. But once you managed to unhorse him, he was the clumsiest thing. He was like a lobster. And all you had to do was to knock him down and crack open his shell with a can opener. So, increased mobility was found to be more effective. So now, this watch business. Watch, guard, always be watching, see? As I say, it creates, it protects, it encourages a style of life which eventually is not worth living, because it is like being the great dictator. It is like trying to be God. If you are the great dictator and you're in charge of everything, you should read a Hindu book called the Arthashastra. This deals with advice to a man who is a Chakravartin, that means a turner of the wheel, or we would say a big wheel, who is the supreme ruler. And it tells him, first of all, that he mustn't trust anyone. No friends for you, my boy. No intimacies. Keep your own counsel. And especially, watch out for women. They have a way of worming secrets out of you for their favors which you want so much. So don't ever get too close to a woman. You can have concubines and prostitutes and everything like that to satisfy your physical needs. But don't fall in love. And trust no one. Then arrange it so that everybody around you mistrusts everyone else. You have set up what's called a kind of negative mandala. A mandala is a circle of power. You so arrange it that your immediate ministers are at odds with their subordinates. Why? Because if your immediate ministers do anything to betray you, their subordinates who want to occupy the superior position will sneak on them to you. Then you knock off the Grand Vizier and put someone in his place, because he's fool enough to want to get up there, but still. Then outside that rank, you have another rank of people at odds with those, and so all the way down, divide and rule. Then you live at the center yourself, and you have a secret passage connecting your inmost center with somewhere down the river where you've got a boat waiting, in case anything goes wrong. And on the way out, there's a stone which you can remove. And when you remove this keystone as you escape through your underground passage, the entire palace will collapse. kill everyone in it. He gives you architectural instructions how to do this. Then, of course, you have to have poison testers for your food. Eat nothing until someone else has eaten it and see if they drop dead. And then you have to have guards standing beside you, always, day and night. But there are other guards secreted behind panels in the wall who are watching the guards guarding you. And so you can't really ever sleep except with one eye open. You can never be like an ordinary inconspicuous individual and take a carefree walk in the park, because you have got to be in control 24 hours a day. So do you see how Big Brother, this is a Hindu version of Big Brother, is the greatest prisoner of all? He is the captive of his own survival system. He can never go this way. He'd find it very difficult too to go this way. He has to be all the time playing God, playing the personal autocratic monarch of the universe. Now you may think this very courageous and so on, but in the end the game isn't worth the candle. It has to fall apart. So always watch it, that what you fight for is worth fighting for, and that it's something other than fighting for fighting for. Because otherwise you start fighting for fighting for fighting for, fighting for fighting for fighting for. So these then, in sum, are the advantages and limits of waking consciousness. That it is a version of the world where what is important is what is valuable for survival, where we live for a future, where we live always watchful for trouble, because death is the thing most of all to be avoided. But this is a form of life which is always in danger of becoming not worth living, and which totally ignores a whole world of experience going on all the time around us, which is magical, gorgeous, and far surpassing in depth and wonder most of the things which ordinary waking consciousness people call pleasures.